Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, everybody, our next guest is someone that I've been following since I was a young guitar player, and just always been in awe of him, reading his articles, checking out the DVDs. I actually have couple of DVDs of his from when he did the Ultimate Gibson book and the Ultimate Fender book. I want to ask him about that today. He has a new record out. It's called The Grand Design. And he is the guitarist's guitarist. We have Mr. Carl Verheyen. How are you, Carl?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks so much for asking.
Thanks for being on the show. I'm so glad to have you here. As I was saying to you just a moment off mic, you and I met once before, and one of the things I'm always have trepidation meeting, you know, somebody that I really admire, because you never know what you're going to get. You know, you don't know what they're going to be like as a person. And when I met you, you didn't know me from Adam, and I came over to you and I said, you know, how much I enjoy your playing and everything. And you were just so genuine and so open and willing to talk. And honestly, I was like, almost like, wow, I don't know what else to say.
Oh, man. Well, that's nice. You know, it doesn't do anybody any good to be anything less than friendly and kind, you know, on the road. I'm out there. I did four tours last year, and
wow.
I ended up being in 12 different countries over the course of, you know, maybe 3 months. And you find lifetime fans in the most far flung of places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a real honor for me to meet them, because I'm amazed that they know, you know, the second song on my second album that came out in 1994.
Yeah.
You know, I'm always just blown away. And in my travels with Supertramp, the leader of the band, he has the same mentality. He basically said, you know, a fan is really worth a lot because of the devotion and the spreading of the word and the money they spend on, you know, a ticket to the show and a CD and, you know, a t-shirt. Or, you know, he basically says you just got to treat them all with respect. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I felt that anyway, but to hear somebody that heavy say it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And, you know, it's I hear it from people that know about you, and I hear it from people that know you and have worked with you, you know, like John Jorgensen and Albert Lee. And I just had Lonnie Spector on just recently, and he can't say enough wonderful things about
you.
He's so electric, isn't he?
Yeah, he's on fire. He loves what he's doing.
Oh, he sure does.
For sure.
So, you know, you started playing guitar when you were 11 years old, and what was it, on your 11th birthday, you got a guitar from your grandmother, right?
Yeah, and a lesson later that day.
And it was $2.50, right?
Yeah. And the guy that was teaching me, the guy they found to teach me, was a guitar player named John Merrill. And he was in a band called the Peanut Butter Conspiracy. And they were getting played on the radio.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, wow, I'm getting to take a guitar lesson from this guy who's on the radio. And, you know, they had an album out, kind of psychedelic. You know, they were like, they were a little bit like, you know, the Seeds or the Electric Prunes, you know, those psychedelic LA bands that were happening back then.
Yeah.
But the trippy thing was, the guy lived at his mom's house. He lived at home. So he couldn't have been more than 20, 21 years old. And he lived at home and had a upright piano in his bedroom, which I thought was just awesome, you know,
mm-hmm.
being an 11-year-old.
And you can't, you know, you growing up in California, which was at that during the time that you were coming up, was such a mecca for great music and great guitar players. Was there a lot of osmosis going on as far as, you know, what the scene?
Well, in my real young days, the cool thing in LA was there was two local stations that, you know, after school, like 3 o'clock on, they'd play these surf shows that just were footage of guys surfing and surf music. And that was really cool because I'd come home and whether I watched the surfing or not, I was paying real close attention to the reverb-drenched Stratocasters and Tellys and, you know, just that surf music. It was actually pre-Beatles, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if I was playing yet, but I just turned it on because I just loved the music. Then we had a cool thing at night, and it's so funny because I've heard so many people talk about the radio and how it influenced their musical upbringing. But we had a cool show at night called the Johnny Otis Show, and I think it was broadcast out of Pasadena Sunday nights at 10. And it was blues, you know, and R&B. And this Johnny Otis guy had a hit with the song Hand Jive, and his son Shuggie Otis was, you know, a hot little 335 player. And I think Johnny was a white dude and married to a black lady, and so Shuggie Otis was kind of half and half. And I just remember it being super hip music that was nothing like Beatles or Stones or anything. It was just total R&B and you know, burning blues guitar playing. And I remember that having a big influence. And I'd go to bed and then turn on the transistor and have it on the pillow and listen to that stuff. That was really cool. Hmm. And, you know, it's funny because I haven't thought of that in years.
Yeah.
And this kind of just dragged it up out of me. And I went, yeah, I remember just couldn't wait for Sunday nights at 10.
That's cool. I got to hear some of that. Was it sort of like an Ike Turner kind of thing?
Yeah. And it was a review, you know, and he would play all these different artists and his own stuff. And
mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool.
That was cool.
You know, that was probably my introduction to the blues pre-Cream.
Yeah.
You know, and pre-Stones. When the Stones were playing the blues, you didn't really know it was the blues at that age. You just thought, wow, this is great rock and roll.
Right.
But then by the time Cream came around, and we're doing songs like Sitting on Top of the World, you know, mm-hmm. old Howlin' Wolf songs and mm-hmm. Spoonful, Willie Dixon song. At that point, you know, I realized, okay, now I get it.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, I had
blues classics.
Totally. I had Joel Danzig on, and he and I were talking about how he came to the blues. And, you know, it was through the British Invasion that he got most of that stuff until he went and got a guitar lesson with Mike Bloomfield. And,
oh wow, that
and,
must have been something.
Yeah, he said, I want to play this Stone song, and Bloomfield was like, no, man, you don't want to play that. You want to play this, and he gave him some addresses to go down on Maxwell Street and get some vinyl there, you know, and he realized very soon, like, oh my God, these are not the originators of that. It's these other guys are the originators of that, you know, which is pretty fascinating. So,
no kid.
Being a guitarist that is, you're so well versed in, you know, you're in every style I can imagine, and also being an excellent sight reader. When you're doing all of this and you're playing this whatever music you're playing, how much of it is cerebral, and how much of it is heart-based or emotional?
Well, when you're in the thick of it, it's all just heart-based because you don't have to refer to music theory, you know. And I've always had this feeling that theory, music theory, is only there to explain and prove why what you just played sounds great,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean, or what you just played sounds wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what theory's there for, you know. And you know, I know music theory inside and out. You know, it's just very logical, and I probably knew everything I needed to know by age 20. You know, the sixth chord in B flat major is a G minor seventh, and that the ninth of E flat is a F, you know, is an F. And, you know, I just knew all that stuff and where chords come from and how to harmonize the major scale, and therefore how to write songs that aren't just folk songs with all diatonic harmony, you know. But when you're improvising and you're in the heat of the moment, to get back to your question, it's just what you want to hear, you know, and you hear a soaring line across a B flat 7 chord, and you connect that to the next chord, you know, maybe one of the guide tones, one of the chord tones in the next chord, and bend to it, you know, and that's just because I'm hearing that in that moment. But I'm not thinking, well, if I start on the third of the E flat of the B flat chord, which is a D, and I run up the Mixolydian mode to a C natural, I can bend that up to a D flat, which would be great for the seventh of the E flat chord. You know, I don't go through any of that stuff. It's just right on the top of my head, and I play what I'm hearing.
Right.
And but that's. People ask you, like, where, how do you get to that point, which I call, like, the flow state, when music is just flowing through you and right out of you. And, I mean, the way you get to that point is you do a lot of studying, you know, you know, there's many levels to play, for instance, to play the blues. You can play at a very, very simple level, which is all one scale, the minor pentatonic on everything, you know, kind of like Albert King does, or you can mix the minor and major pentatonics like B.B. King does and come on and Freddie King and Clapton and all those guys and come up with the next level of blues improvisation, or you can get a little heavier than that and add the Mixolydian mode for each key and combine minor, major pentatonics and Mixolydian mode. And then when you get into the jazz blues, you know, where you have some upper structure tensions like sharp 9, flat 9, sharp 5, flat 5, that kind of stuff, you begin to add those altered scales. So we just talked through four different levels of playing the blues. But, you know, I call it like tapping into the creative pool. You know, you can tap in at any one of those levels. You can say, I just feel like playing a simple as Albert King, you know, and just bend and vibrato and just ring everything you can out of those 5 or 6 notes, you know what I mean? You can tap in at that level, or you can tap in at the level of Wes Montgomery or Joe Pass or something, and or Coltrane or Sonny Rollins and really get sophisticated with it. So it's all good and it's all valid, and nobody needs to say, oh, that's too simple, I would never play that. Because at any level, I mean, look at Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, I mean, just like ringing it out, and it's so powerful and so emotional, you know, you just can't touch that. And yet there's not really a lot of sophistication harmonically going on there, you know, it's pretty much simple stuff, but it's all feel.
Yeah, passion, yeah, and fury for sure. So for living in a world, I mean, you know, for our audience out there, and you know, many people, we all live in a world of instant gratification. Press the button, feel good. Press the button, feel good. The maturation process for this and for what you've done. This didn't happen overnight for you. I mean, maybe it came a little bit easier to you because I think you have a natural proclivity to it. But I think, you know, it'd be interesting to hear you kind of expand upon the idea of what that took for you to get to that place.
Well, you know, you start off playing and taking lessons, of course, maybe, you know, with a teacher. And you start off just playing stuff you want to play and things. And then eventually a teacher will come along and say, you need to read music. Well, I totally revolted at that. And I only learned to read music when I had to teach myself to read music when I was really losing work. And there's some great readers in L.A. that were getting all this great work, and I wasn't. And that was an eye opening thing, you know. Like, wait a minute, if I'm going to compete on that level, I gotta come to the party here and learn to read. And I taught myself to read with the help of a buddy that wanted to read as well. But when you say the maturation, you know, a lot of people play the guitar as a form of relaxation, you know, especially people with full-time jobs, you know, and your listening audience could probably go in, yeah, I'm one of those, you know, to where you have a hard job, you come home from a hard day's work, and you pick up the guitar. And I have a neighbor like that, and he said, you know, I don't know why, I practice all the time. And I said, well, what do you practice when you come home from work? And he says, well, I play Hotel California. And I said, well, that's great. You're playing because you can play Hotel California. You love the way it sounds, and you're just doing that to appease your weary soul is what you're doing. You know, you're tired and you want to just get some gratification, like you say, instant gratification. And this is what you do to chill. And that's not studying. So to learn to be a better guitar player, one needs to study the instrument, and one needs to just say, okay, where are my weak points, and what don't I do well, and why can't I play over this Mahavishnu Orchestra odd time song, or why can't I hear what Elton John's playing on the chorus of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road? You know, why can't I just hear that? What's going on with my ear training? You know, so those are the things that you have to kind of push to improve. I mean, not just those things, but many, many, many other things too, of course.
Right. Well, and then there's the actual the actual technique that goes to a given style or a given form of music. You know, I mean, you play bluegrass, you play blues, you play classical, you play jazz, you play rock, you can play metal, you can play almost any style there is. But that didn't just happen. You had amazing ears. I think that was number one, probably. And I think number two is probably the passion and the desire. You know, the Chinese have a word that's called li, which means intent or intention, and it's about having a strong li that will take you to where you need to be. But so I think those two items, just from my point of view of hearing you all these years and watching you and marveling at what you do, I think those two mechanisms were definitely firm and in place. But do you think it was also about, what kind of embellishing on what you said? Do you think it's more about discipline?
Yeah, I think there's a big part of it is that, because, I mean, even now, I practice as much as I ever did. You
really?
Know, I've been playing for 51 years, but I love to practice. And just recently, I went over to Sweetwater and did a session with Brent Mason. You know, I'm a big fan of his, and I've loved those Alan Jackson records and Brooks and Dunn and stuff there. He's just torn up the solos and his own solo album. So he's kind of a legendary cat in L.A. in that, you know, he never gets out here and tours. He's not interested in having a solo career and a band or anything like that. And so, you know, you never get a chance to see him. And so for me, getting a chance to sit next to him for a couple of days and just see how he does it, it was pretty amazing. And so since I've been home from that, I've been practicing my country Telecaster guitar playing just nonstop, you know, just working on it for 4 hours a day. Just to try to get some of that stuff under my hands that I saw him do.
Yeah.
And but I find that to be really fun, you know, to get my ass kicked and get back into the practice room with new material to work on, and you know, and then some of the problems you have to work out. Like, I never knew that Brent played his main number one guitar that he plays on all that stuff has a B bender on it. And I just went, oh, great. Well, that explains a lot, because I haven't been able to, I can't do that, and I don't know why, and now I get it. You know, it explains a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
He's using a B bender there.
That's crazy. So. He's one of those guys, you know, him and Guthrie Trapp, another guy.
Yeah, Guthrie's killer, too.
Yeah. But when you first started as a studio cat in L.A. in 81... what was the scene like at that point? Who was there? Was it Cartland and people like that?
Yeah, Larry was doing it, and Robin Ford was doing a lot of sessions. Steve Lukather was coming along, you know, he was doing some stuff.
Rittenhour.
And Lee was kind of on his way out of it a little bit, you know, and same with Larry. Larry had started his solo career, but had kept a few big jingle accounts, because the jingles back in the day used to be the most amazing racket by which, you could make so much good back end money, you know, royalty money.
Right.
And I had one jingle that I played on, and the thing took me about 45 minutes to do. It was a solo acoustic thing, and it ended up paying $1,855 a month for the next 4.5 years.
Wow.
So Larry wasn't about to like bail on that stuff quite yet. You know?
Yeah.
So it was just too good to be true.
Wow.
So anyway, but so I kind of broke in. The entry level session stuff seemed to be things like TV shows. So I started with Happy Days and mm-hmm. Laverne and Shirley and some of that stuff and doing. And then eventually I got the TV show Cheers and did that for eight years. You know, the whole eight seasons of Cheers, and you know, just kind of worked my way into the movies and then records and a little bit of everything. So
right, yeah, and you've done tons of movie work, and I've done a little bit of music movie work, and I love doing it. It's so much fun. But you've done so much, and what is that like in regards to, you know, I guess it's very different now than it was back then in 81 when you'd get those jingles and stuff like that. It's a different type of residual now, right?
Well, no, it's still the same. The movie thing is great because they still have a thing called the Musician's Secondary Market Fund, which means when you play on a film that is released in the theater, you get your scale or your double scale, whatever you've negotiated for that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's shown on television, or if they make a DVD and it's sold, or if they show it on an airplane, or if it's shown in any foreign country, that's called a secondary market, and you get paid again.
Mm-hmm.
As do you get a soundtrack, you know, a phonograph record, they call it payment, which is a soundtrack, you know, payment for it. So the movie business is still pretty much a union gig, you know, and thank God, because it's the union has lost so much ground, you know. In most unions have, but our musicians' union has really sadly been beat up, you know, mainly because they make the film companies and the record companies be signatories. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's no law that says you have to be a signatory in the union to the union.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people simply just said, "Nah, we're not going to make union records, or we're not going to make this film union and skate around it." And it's doing musicians a great disservice, because we lose health insurance, we lose pension, we lose everything.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's so funny, because most musicians get into the business without any thought of a pension. You know, this gig has a pension involved, but it really does, and it can be a very good pension. You know, if that's the kind of work you're doing,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it's tough to break into that kind of work, and it only happens in a few cities in America. So
yeah,
you know, there's a lot about it that's difficult. But
oh, for sure. I mean, I mostly work with I've done a lot of work with MTV, and I've done a lot of work with independent filmmakers here in Austin and stuff like that, and
mm-hmm.
some stuff with Silver Cup Studios in New York, but never on the LA level. That's a whole nother thing, I think.
Well, the LA thing, it's a lot of orchestral stuff. So
yeah.
When I played on movies like Star Trek or Cars or Ratatouille, or you know, some of those big Pixar films, you know, it'll be between an 80 and 105 piece orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and so yeah, it's quite a thrill to get into that, you know, to especially if you are a principal soloist,
right,
with an orchestra, you know, it really is heavy. So
yeah, so you know, you actually became a member. You were originally a hired gun, and now you've become a member of Supertramp.
Mm-hmm.
How has that role changed for you? Has it changed at all in regards to being a hired gun?
When I first joined in 1985, it was me and a keyboard player were hired to replace the departing Roger Hodgson, who
mm-hmm.
was, you know, one of the two songwriters. And Rick Davies, who owned the band, he wanted to keep it going as Supertramp, and Roger wanted to have a solo career. So I did a couple tours as a sideman, hired on guy, and then in '96, Rick for a year, Rick had been rehearsing at his house with a handful of us, like every Wednesday night, And it was just a fun hang. You know, we'd go over there. We weren't expecting any money. We were just going over there to jam, and then he'd take us out to Italian food afterward. Mm-hmm. And we'd always just have a – it was a great time because we'd play Muddy Waters tunes and blues tunes and Chuck Berry tunes and just enjoy the camaraderie of hanging and playing with each other. But Rick was throwing in a little original tune every now and again saying, can we work on this a little? You mind? And we go, no, let's play it. So we were playing. We eventually got 10 or 12 songs together. And at the end of the year, they said, okay, we have re-signed our we're no longer on A&M. We are now on EMI Records, and we are going to make a Supertramp record. And here's a big check to pay you for that whole year of rehearsing, which was such a wonderful little bonus. And you are now band members, you know, the guys that weren't. And that was just a real fun period because, you know, kind of the big return of Supertramp and with a new label that really wanted to push it. And it was really cool. And it was so nice to become a band member, you know, instead of a sideman. It was just fun to be in the band. So for financial reasons too, you know, profit sharing and everything.
Mm-hmm. And you guys still go out every year, right?
Well, so here's what went down. Not really. Supertramps, they basically want to keep their thing, their mystique and their show on a really high Pink Floyd level, you know, this, mm-hmm. with the huge stage and gigantic films and screens and the lights. And so we toured 97 and then 2002 we made another record and toured. And then we did a 40-year anniversary tour in 2010. And then we did some more dates in 2011 and 2012, but they were shorter festival tours. And then we were all set to go out in 2015 for another, well, there was 32 arenas and they were sold out, you know, including the O2 Arena in London two nights and the Bercy in Paris two nights, you know. It was going to be another big, huge tour, you know, with the massive lighting and the screens and everything. And we got a call 2 months before the tours was set to start, and this was all in place, you know, with the crew hired and everybody ready to roll, that Rick, the leader of the band, had a real gnarly kind of cancer called multiple myeloma, and tour canceled. So that was 2015, and I went scrambling because my, you know, I had blocked out that whole period and didn't take any festivals or a tour with my own band or anything. So it was tough, but you know, financially, the financial aspect of it paled next to my dear friend Rick, and he's like a mentor to me, you know, being stricken with this kind of blood cancer that's pretty serious. So now he's had 100% recovery, but the deal with these big arena touring acts is that if anyone in the band has had some sort of a surgery or ailment, like a heart bypass or a cancer or something like that, in the last 10 years, the insurance goes up to be six times more. Than normal, you know. So it's just like impossible to tour when you're paying like $1 million in failure to perform insurance. So I don't know. I don't know if it'll ever happen again. Hmm. And it's so sad because Rick was really excited about getting out on the road, and you know he has the time of his life out there.
Yeah.
But you know, once again, he's 72, so. You know, that's getting up there.
Well, I hope it does. I hope it happens again. It would be great.
Yeah, it's a real fun bunch of guys and a great catalog of music to play. And it's as high end as it gets with a private jet and the finest hotels in town. And, you know, so it's as good as it'll ever be for me, I'll tell you that, especially when you compare it to my band.
Well, speaking of your band, you have a new record out. It's called The Grand Design. And I think it's really great, and I have a couple of questions about certain tracks on the record.
Okay, great.
There's a song on there that you wrote, I think you wrote for your mom, right? It's called Closing Time Blues.
Yeah, Closing Time Blues.
Yeah. The solo on there, when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, he should have played with Steely Dan.
Oh man, well that was that kind of a solo, you know, it was meant to not show a lot of flash, but just be toneful, and I ended up using I've got an old 58 Stratocaster, 1958, mm-hmm. and it weighs nothing, you know, it's got a vibrato on it and everything, but it just weighs nothing. It's like 7.2 pounds, and it's so fun to get that thing out. Maple neck, you know, and it's always just got the most killer tone. And so I don't remember what amp we popped it through, but it was instantly inspiring.
It's such a great solo. I mean, the song's great. I love it. I love meshing funk and blues together. I think that's just such a great feel. But the solo,
yeah,
man.
I love when
you hear a solo and you can say and you say, "Well, that's the song within the song."
Oh, cool! Yeah, you can sing that solo, which is kind of cool.
Absolutely, that's what I was talking about.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you like that one. That's a fun song to do live.
Yeah, really good. And then I really dig the song "Angels."
Wow, I'm very happy you said that. Now, to me, the mix and the mastering on that song are pretty close to perfect. You know, it was a song that I knew I had layers. I knew I had textures and layers that were coming. And I knew that a couple of acoustics pan right and left, and a stereo strat, you know, and then I knew some power chords were going to happen, and I knew I wanted a little slide guitar to come in the chorus, I mean, in the bridge, and I knew the solo at the end would be, I mean, there'd be not really a guitar solo, but these little interlude, little lines that I play between some vocals. And I picked my SG for that, you know, and it was one of those songs where, you know, the layering of the various textures and sounds of the guitars on it was one of the most exciting, fun things, because everything we tried was enhancing it and making it a little bit better. And, well, what if we use slide guitar here? Yeah, let's do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just everything we were trying was great. And at the very end of the keyboard session, where I flew my buddy Jim Cox out to Fort Wayne to record on it, I said, well, there is one more song maybe you could do. And I had no plans, and he just made it right over the top, I thought. You know, just a little bit of acoustic piano in there just really, really nailed it for me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, it's a killer tune. And it's a great figure too. That figure that you play in the beginning, it's so great.
Oh, thank you.
I like that.
Thank you so much. That's cool.
And you've got another slide player on there who is just Mr. Sonny Landreth, who we've had on the show.
Yeah.
He's a really great guy. And what was your takeaway from that session?
Well, that was amazing too, because I asked him at a festival we did. I said, "Would you ever consider playing on one of my records?" And he said, "Yeah, in a heartbeat." So when I called him, I said, "I basically wrote a song that was right up your alley, you know, and I think you'd be great on it." So he said, "Can you send it to me?" So I sent it to him, and then when we finally met to do the recording, he said to me, "Well, do you mind if I play your guitar figure an octave up on slide?" I said, "I don't mind at all, but I'm thoroughly convinced it's impossible." And he goes, "No, it isn't. I worked it out." And he showed me, and it just made the whole tune, you know, just to have him play that figure an octave up on the slide. It just made it swampier and greasier and, you know, and he and I had so much fun jamming together on it, because we basically played our solos together and our fills and stuff like that, and just had a great time. I love Sonny. What a good guy.
What a great guitar player.
Yeah, man. His job to bring it to earth, I think.
Yeah, right? there's a track on here that, and tell me if I'm pronouncing it right, Intangibles Collide?
Intangibles.
Intangibles.
Intangibles Collide,
okay.
Yeah.
So Now, I'm trying to understand the where the title is. You know, it's sort of like what Pat Metheny says. He wishes that he didn't have to title any songs at all.
Yeah. Well, for me, see, that song, you know, there's a lot of intangibles about music, little things that you can't touch, you can't reach out and grab, and they're unexplainable in many ways. Mm-hmm. And intangibles collide. I was thinking, well, this song starts on a baritone guitar, and then it has this really gnarly chorus part that's distorted, and then the solo has a ska beat, you know, and it's kind of all over the place, and it's the one instrumental on the record.
Yeah, I was counting guitars on there, and I think I got it right. There's five.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah, I played some acoustics, and the baritone was a gift many, many, many years ago from Alan Holsworth. He had two baritones made by a guy and said, do you want one of these? This one's a bit duller than the other. And so I said, sure. We were jamming together one day. And so he gave me this baritone guitar that's been with me for, you know, maybe 30 years. Right. I've had it since the 80s.
It's such a killer tune, and it's moody. It's your prog rock song, if you will.
yeah, you could say it's a bit prog. I know. That's cool.
It's a good tune.
Right on.
So you have, I mean, you're quite a collector also of guitars. How many do you think you have at this point?
I think I'm around 70.
Yeah,
that's probably what I tell my wife. 50 though.
Oh, you have the same problem.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, we have about 50 guitars, but I know there's more than that. And there's banjos and mandolins and you know, stuff, and little mini guitars, all kinds of stringed things, ukuleles. I got a couple of those.
Uh-huh.
So.
You know, it's so funny to hear you say that. You know, if you've got that problem, you know.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. So,
well, you know, since I've been involved with LSL, they've been making a signature guitar of mine for a few years now.
Right.
And those guys, they just got their product into Sweetwater back in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And that's a huge thing for them because Sweetwater is, you know, probably sells more guitars than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back there and with the owner of the company and did a little presentation with him for the various what do they call them? Sales engineers, you know, for the sales guys. Did one at 7 in the morning and one at 9:30 or something like that. And then the rest of the day there was spent hanging out and, you know, people could come in and pick up the guitars and play them in this big theater they have back there. So I wandered in there and I found this guitar. It's like a thin line Tele, you know, in that it's, you know, the old thin line was basically a hollow Telecaster.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's a little bit like a 335 in that there's a block of wood that goes down all the way to the bridge, you know, under the pickups. And then behind the bridge is hollowed out, and then there's F holes, you know. So I picked up that thing. He calls it a Soledad. It's got a P90 in the neck and a humbucker in the back. Just saying, I wonder what this sounds like, and I fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I came home after that and said, "That I got to have one of those." You know,
that's cool.
I got to get one of those. So that's my latest guitar, and it brings my LSLs up to 4.
Wow, and
really wonderful.
You still keep a rig in Europe?
Yeah, I keep a you know, a rig for my touring in Europe that's all on European voltage and stuff.
Right.
And here in the States, I probably have about 50 guitar amps. And then over there, probably about 6 more.
Wow.
So, amps seem to multiply too.
So if you had to choose one rig to do it all, one guitar, one amp, and a configuration of pedals to do it all. So somebody said to you, okay, look, all the other guitars, you can't use them. You got to use these right here. Which would you choose?
Well, I had a session yesterday that was very last minute. They said we weren't going to use guitar on these tracks, but we decided we needed. Can you come at 1:00? And they let me know at 10:00. And I said, is there cartage? And they said, no, just bring something. So I brought my LSL signature Strat and an acoustic guitar. They asked for a steel string acoustic, and I picked up an old 59 Martin D18. But I brought my Strat, and I brought a Princeton. And I'm a huge fan of the Fender Princeton. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty much ground zero, you know. I don't use those live because those things, I don't play with any drummers that are, you know, that are that quiet, it seems. You know, I could probably play out of a Princeton if it was a real you know, a real quiet jazz gig with brushes, you know, the drummer playing brushes. But in the studio, the Princeton's really nice because it's warm enough. You can turn them up a little bit, and they'll give you a little bit of grit to them. But for the most part, when you keep them around three, it's a really nice, warm, fat, clean sound. And then I just brought a little mini 10-inch by 10-inch pedal board that has a Tube Screamer type pedal. I think it's the Maxon. Uh-huh. And then it has a little delay pedal. I think it's a carbon copy. And then it has a reverb pedal and a tuner. And I only have a reverb pedal in case I'm doing something where, you know, they give you like some weird PV thing or a Marshall that has no reverb, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have that as a backup. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I brought that mini pedal board and one more pedal. I brought a Seymour Duncan Catalina chorus in case they wanted some chorusing, any kind of wiggle sounds, you know, and a Princeton and a Strat. And it just worked fine for the whole session.
Hmm. That's I'm always fascinated by that because I own a lot of guitars. I own a lot of amps. I own a lot of pedals. And sometimes I go to myself, sometimes I say to myself, okay, do I really need all this? Could I make it happen with just, yeah, you know? And I think back to like 1977, 78, 79, when it was one guitar, one amp, and I think one pedal. You know,
yeah, I know, back in the day.
I think about that and I go, okay, I was able to make it happen, but I don't know how good it was sounding in retrospect.
Yeah, you know, we got by with tons less stuff, didn't we, back in the day?
Yeah.
Just didn't need a lot of stuff. And you know, the whole boutique amp market and the whole boutique pedal market, you know, has blown wide open, you know, everybody's trying to find out what everybody's using so they can sound like that. But mm-hmm. We all know that you know, I had Brian May play one of my guitars one time in Chicago. We were backstage somewhere, and he played my guitar, and it was a Strat, and he sounded exactly like Brian May, you know, and it just through an amp, and I went, oh my God, it really is the hands.
Yeah.
It was such an eye-opening experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, once again, like Billy Gibbons says, it's meat on metal on wood.
Yeah. I know. He's right, man. He's so right about that.
So another one of those scenario questions for you. If you could be in a band other than Supertramp, if you could be in a band, what would be your dream lineup? Of course, you on guitar. Who else would be in that band?
Well, I've always been really inspired by. Now, if it's okay to name guys that are already dead,
that's fine.
Yeah, I've always been really inspired by listening to Jaco Pastorius.
Yeah.
He would be such a kick to play with, I would imagine. And he actually came down to a club I was playing in the early 80s, you know, back in his kind of crazy days, mm-hmm. and walked in with his bass, you know, and a chord, and said, "Can I jam with you guys?" And he got on stage and said, "I only want to play with a drummer." And, you know, out of respect, I got off the stage, and now I should have said, no, this is my band. Yeah. You want to play? You play with me, too. You know, I should have said that, but, you know, but I was so in awe of him even then, so.
Yeah.
So anyway, that would be a great guy. On drums, man, there's so many great drummers, and I've played with most of them.
I know you have.
I don't know. Never played with Terry Bozzio. That'd be an interesting experience.
That would be interesting.
That'd be pretty
Jaco
cool.
And Bozzio.
Yeah.
That would be really interesting.
God, that'd be crazy. And I was such a huge Weather Report fan. Although he would probably be a very powerful entity to play with. Joe Zawinul would be an amazing keyboard player.
Yeah.
But having said all that, it'd be really fun to play with Paul McCartney on bass and you know, and John Bonham on drums.
Yeah.
What that sounded like.
Yeah, that would be cool. Well, that's great. It's always interesting to hear, you know, what people think about that type of thing. You know, I got to tell you, being a writer, a teacher, a studio guy, doing movies and TVs, your solo stuff, a side man, being with Supertramp, all this stuff, you've been such an ambassador for this instrument for so long.
Oh, man, well, thank you.
And you know, it's so important that people, I think it's so important that people get to hear you play, because you are really quintessential for this instrument, I think. And you have been for a long time.
Mark.
What's next for you? Well, you've done so much.
You know, I spent so much time on the road last year that this year I'm cooling out, not going to the East Coast. I'll probably do a West Coast tour, and hopefully I'd love to get down your way. The only time I've ever played in Austin was I played at Stubbs doing opening for Keb Moe one night.
Oh,
but it
cool.
was solo acoustic.
Uh-huh.
It was just solo acoustic. And that was, you know, I was kind of lost in the shuffle on a big, big, huge stage like that, but doing the acoustic thing. But I want to open up some more areas with my band. Unfortunately, my drummer got the gig with Hamilton for a 5-month run in San Francisco and a 5-month run in LA.
Wow.
So he called me and said, "Do you think I should do this or not?" And I just said, "You know, we're going to really miss you, but yeah, you got to do it. That's a huge gig. Puts money in your pension, you know, and is steady employment, and gives him a chance to move from the Bay Area down here to LA." So,
yeah.
So I got to kind of regroup in a different capacity, and there's a few ideas I have. One is to put together sort of a blues thing and go out doing the blues music from each one of my 13 albums. You know, I've got a blues or two on each record, and to sort of put that all together with maybe, instead of a trio, maybe make it a keyboard band too, you know, four piece band, and get out there and do a little of that. That's been on my mind for a while.
Yeah, it would be great to see you maybe at, like, the Dallas Guitar Show.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out how to get into that. My agent doesn't know how to do it. So
well,
if you have any connections,
I actually,
there,
yeah, when we get off mic, I will give you a number.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Great.
Be great.
What month does that happen, by the way?
That's going to be this May, early part of May this year.
Oh, great.
And it's the 40th anniversary, too, this year.
Wow, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast.
They do quite a few performances, don't they?
They do. They have three stages.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, it'd be really wild. I mean, people would really, I'd love it, that's for sure.
Oh, great. Well, I got called to play this thing called the Crown of the Continent Guitar Festival. I think it's in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And the other players are Sonny Landreth, Brent Mason, Mike Stern, who are all buddies of mine, and David Lindley, who would be fun to hang out with.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of his.
There's somebody I want to talk to, for sure. I mean, talk about a really recognizable sound. You hear him and you immediately know it's him, you know.
Yeah. He plays the most amazing solo on this Blind Boys Out of Alabama record. And the song is called Jesus Is Gonna Be Here. And he just plays exactly what you would sing if you were just singing a solo, you know. Mm. When I first heard it, I just kind of go, God, that's exactly what I would have done had I had that feel and the, you know, because it's a lap steel thing. But it's so perfect, you got to go, damn. You know, Jesus Is Going to Be Here by the Blind Boys of Alabama.
Well, that's cool.
One of the most perfect little guitar solos I ever heard him do.
Nice. That's beautiful. Well, Carl, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out to talk with me today. This has been a blast for me, and I've been looking forward to doing it for a long time. This show has been around for over 5 years now, and you were one of those people that I made a long list of people that I wanted to talk to, and you were definitely one of them.
Thanks so much, Mark.
I really appreciate it. We're going to sign off.
Too.
We're going to sign off right here, but you hold on 1 second, and we'll speak to you soon. Thanks.
All right.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and of course, on guitarradioshow.com.